argument, Barrows versus Wiley. Mr. Pines.
May it please the court, I'm Lester Pines. I represent the plaintiff appellant Paul Barrows. This case involves a question of due process, and the matter before the court revolves around the issue of whether or not Mr. Barrows was deprived of a property interest and whether or not he was entitled to process before that property interest was denied him. The record in this case clearly reflects that Mr. Barrows was denied process. He most certainly was deprived of property without the due process of law.
Mr. Pines, I had a question for you about the guidelines that the university uses, because it appears to me that if a limited appointee with an academic staff backup, such as Mr. Barrows had, is terminated, which I know is his position, it says the appointee has no minimum notice rights. However, the appointee has the right to assume the backup appointment without a separation in service. And I want to know, who has the burden of invoking that? I mean, having the right to do something doesn't mean they're necessarily going to force it on you. Didn't he have the obligation to speak up and say, actually, yes, now I'm ready to go back to my provost office backup position?
Well, there's nothing that indicates that he has the obligation to specifically do that.
But how do they know if it's just a right? It doesn't say something like the university will automatically move him as by opportunity. You know, see what I mean?
Yes, but he did have very direct conversations with the chancellor and with other high administrative officials about his desire to return to work.
But there were lots of negotiations. Return to work, how, I guess, is the question, because at least one way of looking at this is that he knew he had the right to go back to the provost's office, but he made the calculation in his mind that he would actually be better off economically if he just used these various forms of leave for a while he saw whether there was some better job than the $72,000 in some job.
Well, that may have been the case at early in this process with the chancellor, but the fact of the matter is that he clearly expressed a desire to return to work. He was not allowed to return to work in any capacity, even though he was in discussions about some capacity that he might return to other than his backup position. That's number one. And that was involuntary. He had no control over coming back to work until they were ready to let him come back to work after he had been placed on this involuntary leave.
But you're saying that, but yet we don't see whether he ever actually said, just put me in the provost office.
Well, I think the record does not show that he ever said, just put me in the provost office. But the record is clear that when he said he wanted to return to work, on repeated occasions, he was told he could not return to work. And in addition to being deprived of the property interest that we claim that he had in the backup position, by being forced on that involuntary leave, he was not only forced to use his sick leave benefits, but he was also forced to use $35,000 of his vacation benefits.
Yeah, but you see, you haven't monetized these benefits he lost. We know that he had $75,000 additional take-home pay, and then but he lost some future benefits. But you haven't estimated the value of those future benefits.
Well,
sick leave isn't. You know, it depends when he retired and so on and so forth. I didn't see any, you know, computation.
Well, putting aside, first of all, with regard to the sick leave, he was forced to use the sick leave involuntarily.
That's true. So he lost some sick leave, but what is that worth that he lost?
Well, I'd like to focus on the vacation.
That's my question. Well, what is it worth that he lost?
He lost the value 2 years hence.
What is the value of the sick pay before you've used it?
The value of the sick pay before you used it is what he said the value was, his opinion that 2 years hence when he would have retired. In his affidavit, he stated what the value of that sick leave was. And that he was eligible for retirement in 2 years.
But I think I had the same question. I don't know why the value of his sick leave is computed on the basis of the $191,000 some salary, or whether it should be computed on the basis of a rolling average of 3 years, or whether it should be computed on the basis of the last salary he had at the university. I mean, there's a real absence of concrete numbers here.
The Dr. Barrow's affidavit indicated and stated that the rules and regulations which were cited there provide for the sick leave to be calculated at the last at the highest salary, and that's in the rules that were cited.
Wait a second. You mean after he is demoted and is getting $72,000, a day of sick leave will be valued at his old salary?
The sick leave that he had accumulated during that time was valued at his old salary and continued to be valued at his old salary. When he accumulated new sick leave, it was valued at his new salary. But, Judge, I did want to...
Yes, but ordinarily you have to be sick to use your sick leave, right?
Except at the University of Wisconsin, if you have accumulated sick leave left at the time you retire, you can convert that at twice its value to health insurance benefits.
Yes, and now what are health insurance benefits worth?
What are health insurance benefits worth? Well, that particular amount is not in the record.
Well, that's critical, right? If what he lost amounts to additional health benefits, that obviously has some value, but that value has to be monetized in order to compare it with the $70,000 that he gained.
Well, he did lose vacation benefits, which do not need to be monetized.
Look, but what...
They don't need to be monetized. They had a current value. They were his property. He could take that.
So what were they worth?
That was a $35,000 loss.
Well, okay, he's $35,000 ahead now until you figure out what these health benefits are worth.
Well, he was not $35,000 ahead. I'm sorry, I misspoke. He was $28,000 behind at the point he went into his backup position in June.
Why isn't this all set forth in some, you know, compact... away with a bottom line, so we know whether your client gained or lost as a result of all this turbulence.
Well, we can put aside the sick leave completely and just focus on the vacation and ALRA, which was his property, which he could cash out at any time that he left the university. That's in the record. He lost $28,000. It had a $35,000 approximate value at the time he was placed on his involuntary leave. At the end of that involuntary leave, the value of it was $6,000 because $7,000. He had used approximately $28,000 of that vacation. That is real monetary loss.
Yeah, but that has to be offset against the $70,000 gain.
Well, that's not correct, Judge, because even if he earned salary, he would still have had that vacation money and he would still have had the salary. You don't use your vacation time while you're working and being paid. He wasn't paid a salary during this involuntary leave. He had to use that vacation money.
Yes, but if he had been bounced down to the $72,000, his backup entitlement, he would have had a lower salary. So
that's
he would
correct.
Have had less money.
He would have had less money, but he still would have had the $35,000 in vacation.
He would have had $70,000 less salary. That's not fully offset by this vacation money, vacation leave, right?
The vacation money, the vacation leave, and the ALRA leave are in an account. They belong to him. That's like a savings account.
My question. I don't care about. Look.
I don't understand. I don't exactly understand what you're asking.
If he benefited financially, to the tune of $70,000 additional salary that he wouldn't have had if he had immediately moved into his backup job, that $70,000 is something that the university conferred on him, and it has to be an offset against any financial loss that he incurred because of sick leave and vacation leave.
Had he been placed in his backup position between November 05 and June of 06, November 04 and June of 05, and he had earned that $72,000 in salary, he would still have had all of his vacation money.
But not at that high rate. You're saying that was locked in. If he were getting $72,000 a year and he went on vacation, that's not the high value. If he used the vacation while he was getting paid $72,000.
The vacation that he owned at that point had the value.
You sure of that?
I believe that the record reflects that.
I didn't see
and
it.
Even if the record, even if the value of what was in his ALRA account did not go down once he was placed in his backup position. And even if it did go down, he still would have suffered a monetary loss.
Suppose he had been immediately put in the backup position without this delay. What would have been his net worth if he'd been placed in his backup position promptly? Would his net worth as it is? As a result of the delay in putting him in the back.
Would his net worth have declined?
Would have declined or would have increased?
It would have declined by the
fact... I don't understand that, because he'd get the extra $70,000. I mean, he got the extra $70,000 as a result of transmuting sick leave, into money, into cash. That was a benefit to him.
But he also
benefit.
But putting that aside,
so what's the net? I'm not going to put it aside. I want to net it against the loss of the accrued vacation and sick leave.
Well, the value of that sick leave benefit was was $194,000 2 years hence at his retirement. So there was a value. Now, whether we placed the right value or the wrong value on it in the submission to the court, we placed an admissible value on it. And the district court said, completely ignored that admissible evidence in then granting summary judgment to the defendants. Okay. Now, that is a question of weight of the evidence, not a question of whether or not we put admissible evidence in the record.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pine. Mr. Lattice? Ms. Lattice, sorry.
May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Lattice. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Wisconsin. My client today is John Wiley, chancellor of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. This case today is about a man who made a choice. On November 4th of 2004, when Dr. Barrows was asked to step down from his limited appointment, his at-will appointment as vice chancellor, he could have requested placement into his backup position, as Judge Woods has pointed out. He never did.
Ms. Lattice, I have sort of the opposite question for you. In the regulations, it seems to use quite different language for people who resign than it does for people who are terminated. People who resign from their position do seem to have an affirmative obligation. The word request, ask to be returned to the position, I think is the exact language that's used, and it says such requests should be honored as soon as possible. Whereas for people who are terminated, it doesn't say anything like that. It just says, however, the appointee has the right to assume the backup appointment. So my question is, why the difference in language if the bottom line is the same, if everybody has to request?
Right, and the difference in language is confusing because the statute the regulation that refers to the termination refers to a person who was terminated who already had held a previous position in the academic staff, which Dr. Barrows never had. In fact, there was no university regulation that specifically addressed the situation that Dr. Barrows had, which was as a limited appointee who had never held any position for the university other than an at-will appointee and had in fact been given the right to the backup appointment as something along during his tenure at the university. So the regulations were never specifically applicable to this situation in either event. We used that one as the closest one. Now,
there is a difference, though. I mean, when we're focusing on, and I think at the summary judgment stage, we have to assume he was terminated. I recognize there's some noise in the background about that, but I think it's taking the facts favorable to him. He was terminated, and the regulation we're looking at just says he has the right to assume the backup appointment, and he's saying that he did not have any obligation. They should have immediately transferred him to that appointment, and then all of this back and forth about whether he was going to get some more attractive job could have happened while he was at least in the $72,000 position.
And it just wouldn't make sense to interpret that regulation, which doesn't apply anyway, as something that required the university affirmatively as a matter of federal law to immediately place him into this backup position. There's no federal law that could attach to that sort of interpretation that would require that as a matter of federal law
when all was said and done, did the actions of the university deprive him of vested property rights he had? Obviously, state law governs whether they had vested or not, but if these were vested rights to be paid, as his lawyer's arguing, at whatever the rate was at the time he earned them, in other words, a day of vacation when he was earning $191,000 is worth something based on that amount. I don't know if that's right or not, but it sounds sort of interesting. It sounds like if he goes on vacation while he has a $72,000 job, he suddenly gets a bump in pay.
Right, and there's no support in the record for that.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, but if he's deprived of a vested right, then there is a federal problem because nobody ever gave him any opportunity under Loudermill or anything else to confront what these problems were. If it's not a vested right, or if he in fact netted out favorably and just sort of made a rational economic choice between burning up some sick leave and annual leave versus moving into the job, that's a whole different
matter. Yeah, and that's what he did. He made a rational economic choice. He benefited substantially by remaining in the vice chancellor position on leave time because that salary was three times what he would have made in the backup position. And he obviously benefited professionally, too, from that.
How many benefit? That seems like a stretch.
Because if you're looking for another job, it's far better to look for it as vice chancellor than it is at the backup position.
As suspended vice chancellor under investigation? I don't know about that.
Say, just as a detail, why does your jurisdictional statement, in fact, talk about Rule 54B?
I don't know.
Wait, you don't know why your own jurisdictional statement talks about 54B?
I don't know. I don't remember why.
I mean, that's for cases where, you know, the judge has entered judgment on a sort of severable part of the, and there's something else kicking around in the district court. But there isn't anything in the district court.
There's nothing. Yeah. To the best of my knowledge, as I stand here today, I don't think it was appropriate to cite that in the jurisdictional statement.
Okay, thank you. But now, are we confident? I didn't understand when I was asking Mr. Pines what his answer was. Do we know that he, as a result of the, you know, using the sick leave to in effect continue the receipt of his vice chancellor salary, that he actually comes out ahead? So, yeah, he has more cash as a result of continuing at the vice chancellor level, but he's doing that by using up, is it just sick leave or sick leave plus vacation, some combination?
He used up a combination of some sick leave and some vacation.
So he lost something, right? Lost something. So has what he lost been monetized so we can compare it with what he gained?
No. It was never monetized by the plaintiff.
Can you clarify the Wisconsin regulations at least? Does Wisconsin, when somebody retires, look at the last salary or an average or the highest salary? Or
Yes, they do look at the highest salary.
So in his case, it would be the 191.
For the sick leave purposes, not for the vacation. But for the sick leave purposes, they do look at the highest salary. But what was not done in this case was any calculation as to what that would amount to in terms of health insurance benefits, because health insurance benefits cost X amount per month.
So sick leave isn't translated into cash. It's translated into some sort of insurance.
Right.
Policy.
At no time can you cash that out. And you can't cash out the vacation either.
But you have to pay for the sick leave benefits after you retire. There'd be a deduction, wouldn't there, from your pension
from
check?
Pension check, but from this account that's set aside for you to pay for the sick leave benefits insurance benefits.
It's like a premium.
It's like a premium.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the premium would be higher. You'd have more. You would pay more if he had retained that as opposed to having expended it earlier.
He would have benefits that lasted longer, but
so that's what I'm saying. It doesn't seem quite right to say he doesn't cash them out. I mean, if he's actually getting a monetary value from these benefits post-retirement, even if it's almost in kind, if it's in the form of health insurance payments, health insurance is expensive for people.
Right.
We've
never argued that the sick leave benefits weren't worth something.
Do we know what that? Suppose for some given level of benefits, the premium that he would have to pay would be, $10,000 a year, and for that same level of benefits, because of his, if he had all his sick leave, he would have had, cost him only $5,000 a year. Something. Is there any computation of that sort?
There's nothing. There's nothing.
Numbers somewhere in the record from which a computation could be made, or was nothing ever presented?
No, there are no numbers from which such a computation could be made, because we would need an expert opinion to tell us how much health insurance premium would be likely to be, when he would be likely to retire, how much sick leave he might be likely to use up before that, and of course what the present value of that is to him today, because he's not even being deprived of that now. So there's plenty of time for pre-deprivation process if for something in the future. He's got to show what value that has to him today and then deduct that from the difference in the salaries. At least that's how the district court viewed the case in order to determine an economic loss. We had to look at the whole picture of what his financial position was at the time that he claims he was deprived of something without due process.
The sick leave that he took and got, I guess, paid for was because he was sick, as I recall.
For part of the time he was sick, that's correct.
Well, that's why you don't get sick leave unless you're sick, do you?
Right. And that was a huge public debate at home in Wisconsin at the time that this all became public. But, under Wisconsin rules, it was inappropriate to allow him to use sick leave when he wasn't sick.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Lattice.
Thank you.
Mr. Pines, your time expired, but we'll give you another minute if you want.
Thank you, Judge. This matter came up on a motion for summary judgment on the issue of qualified immunity, and the record was developed during a stay of discovery. We believe that the record that was developed and the facts that are in the record were sufficient to have raised material issues of fact and dispute, and that this matter should not have been dismissed on summary judgment. My reading of the district.
Were you planning to hire an expert to estimate the value of what you lost? Or?
Well, I sure am now. If the case is certainly if the case was sent back for trial, we certainly would. But with regard to the schedule in this matter and the issue that was raised by the state and the timing under the scheduling order of the court with a stay of discovery, this was not something that it was apparent. Could be done by us at that time. We believe that the record and the law with regard to our statements as to the value of these benefits was sufficient, and that the question of whether or not we had proven the case at trial was an issue of weight, not an issue of whether or not the opinions that Dr. Barrows gave with regard to the value of his benefits was admissible evidence. And I think that's really the problem that we face here, that ultimately this was a summary judgment motion solely on the issue of qualified immunity, and that the record was not fully developed. But nevertheless, I contend that that Paul Barrows did provide enough evidence in this record to show that he suffered a loss from not being immediately placed into that backup position, but also that he did suffer monetary losses because at the end of the day in June, he had less money in terms of value in his vacation benefits, regardless of how they're calculated. The value that the university gave him that's in his affidavit was less than what he started out with. To me, that is admissible evidence, and if the university wanted to contend otherwise, then we should have had a trial. It should not have been resolved this way.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pine and Ms. Lutz. The court will take a brief recess before hearing the other cases.